Well, let's welcome back manager Chris Coast. Chris, do you have team updates for us?
The past week we've had a few releases, a couple of pitchers and a hitter, and then just today we're bringing in bringing back Forrest Allday to play some outfield and either bat second or put him down a lineup until he starts getting back into the baseball swing of things, so to speak. So we're at a stage now, and I think a lot of teams are in this way where you can make a couple changes here and there, but you got to kind of roll with the team that's have and hope they get hot for an extended streak.
You know, it's kind of funny you were saying that, because I was talking with Sean Aronson, the play-by-play guy, last night for the Saints, and he was saying, you know, you could look at your team and you could say, well, okay, I could make some moves, but I mean, who do you replace? I mean, the guys you got there are still outstanding talent, so it must be kind of hard to determine. Well, I could bring in another guy, but who am I getting rid of here?
Yeah, between the trying to replace players that you know can get hot and live up to their abilities, and then the COVID situation between testing and getting a new guy approved, and then there's also salary issues. You know, sometimes you get lucky where some of your better players are not real high-paid guys, or if you're in the if you have major issues, you're in the situation where some of your better players are underachieving and they're making high salaries, and you have some decisions to make. But once again, trying to replace players in this climate of between COVID and travel and everything in between, it makes it tough. But like a lot of teams, we feel really good about the names in our team. We just haven't really hit a stride yet. So for us, it's less about making a bunch of moves. We feel good about the team that we have on paper. And I know I sound like a broken record, because every time you and I have spoken, I've said on paper, we look pretty good, but that is in fact the case. So we just need to bring our papers out to home plate with us and get some hits.
Before jumping into fan questions, I did want to mention Matt Tomsha, named by the league and by This Week in the Association as the Pitcher of the Week. He had quite a week for you.
Yeah, he's one of those guys, and we brought him in. It only took him one or two appearances before he was going to get stretched out and do what he did the other day against Milwaukee. But he is one of those guys where I wish every independent league player could watch what he does on a regular basis, because the games he's not starting, he's either doing the chart and watching every pitch, and even days when he really has no responsibilities other than get his work in earlier in the day, which he does pretty extensively. But just during the games, he watches every single pitch. You'll see him at the top step of the dugout, watching the opponents, watching the hitters, just basically loving the game first and foremost. That's a huge part of it. He just loves being around the game. But just the attentiveness to all the little things, and then you combine that with ability, hard work. We are lucky to have him, first of all, but keep your eye on Matt Tomsha, because he still has a pretty strong baseball future when you combine the love of the game, the attentiveness to everything that he needs to do to succeed, and then, of course, flat-out ability, because he is actually really good.
Well, we'll jump into fan questions, and we start with Jim, who says, Chris, can you explain why you had Cozart start for one inning, then turn to Williams to go five or six? What is the reasoning behind that move?
We've used openers, actually, I think on four different occasions, and I think we've won three of those games. We might have won all four, to be honest, I can't remember, but it was circumstantial. It was a situation where we knew we had issues with middle relief just not being available that particular day. We knew we had situations where if we could get to the eighth inning, we had a better chance to win the game rather than try to have a reliever in the sixth or seventh. So it made sense to put that middle relief to start the game and just see what happens. If they give up runs, we can overcome that early in the game and hopefully come back from it. And it happens to have worked for us quite a bit this year. Never in my wildest dreams that I think if I became manager, I would use an opener, but I've become incredibly open-minded to it because it just shortens the game. And I'll give you examples of my personal career. When I was with the Phillies, 2007, 2008, we won the division over the Mets. And, of course, we go on to win the World Series in 2008. But in 2007, our bullpen, and also in 2008, our bullpen in middle relief especially was amazing. And the Mets bullpen was not. And if we had flip-flop bullpens, they would have won the division by like 15 games. So that middle relief And we just, so when we use those openers, our middle relief, it wasn't that we didn't trust them, it's just we didn't have much available. We used Kosho a couple different times, and he was on a limited pitch count. And even the one time we used Helton, we had to get him an inning, and we didn't want to put him in a stressful situation in the sixth or seventh in a tie game. So it depends on how your roster is built. The opener situation can work really, really well. And I'll be honest with you, as a manager, it's our toughest job over the course of the season is always going to be managing the bullpen, running it the right way, not overusing guys, using guys enough but not too much. And when you can shorten a game, even by one inning, there's just huge value in that as a manager.
And Williams pitched very well in two of those appearances for you.
Yeah, he's a true professional. The first time I brought it up to him, I wasn't nervous. I knew he'd handle it pretty well. But, you know, starters are a creature of habit. If it's a 7 o'clock game, at 6:30 they're doing this. At 6:40 they're doing that. At 6:50 and so on and so forth, that one-inning situation, I didn't want it to mess him up too much. But, you know, him being the professional that he is, he basically thrived in it. Not only did he just accept it, he thrived in it. And I think maybe on three different occasions we used an opener for his games, and it's just – it's gone really well, and there may not even be a situation where we do it again, just based on the way our bullpen situation is now lined up. But if it makes sense, we will definitely do it more in the future.
You talked a little bit about this already, but our next question is from Oscar. He says, "It looks like the Red Hawks are right on the verge of doing something special. Can you feel that?"
Yes, because early in the year when we were really struggling, we were usually struggling in more than one part of the game. One would really get magnified, especially playing Winnipeg. They're such a good team that if you have a weakness, they will find it, and then they'll absolutely exploit it and step on your throats, and that's what they've done to us. Whether it was on a particular day our bullpen was needed more rest, and all of a sudden they would get the starter out early, or stealing bases, or whatever the situation was, they just found ways to explore any weakness we have or had. And so now we feel like we have fewer weaknesses. We've addressed some issues. Our bullpen is a little bit stronger now. Our starting pitching is now stretched out. Offensively, we had been doing really, really well, and all of a sudden it seems like even though our offense is really good, we're just haven't hit that stride on a consistent basis. Because offensively, you look at some of the people in our lineup, it's a really, really good lineup. It's not, you know, the 1927 Yankees, but it is a pretty good lineup. We just haven't hit that stride. So, in my opinion, our starting pitching is going to be pretty good. Our relief is going to be pretty good. Our offense is pretty good. We just haven't consistently put it together. So, for us to win a lot of games and get back in this, it's now a situation where our offense needs to come out and be consistent and be just a constant threat. Hopefully that's what, when we added Forrest Allday, he will give that to us a little bit. He's not going to hit for a ton of power, but he's going to work. He's basically going to be like a second Brennan Metzger up there, where he's really going to put a lot of pressure on the pitchers to throw strikes and battle at bats and get pitch counts up. And hopefully him and Metzger getting on base for our middle of the order, that's a formula for success.
Two Brennan Metzgers is never a bad thing. Oscar also asks, what needs to be done to beat those gold eyes?
We just need to put nine innings of really good baseball together. I know it sounds simple and it's obvious, but it's really that's the case, because I think the gold eyes are really good. I don't think that's any question mark. We saw that in exhibition season. We looked at the roster, they're starting pitching, but we do, in fact, match up with them pretty well. If you go man for man, it's tough to match up with them, but we do. We have a lot of players who can match up with their guys, and the motivation I've tried to give our guys was something that I used over the course of my career, and that was, if I was the catcher that particular day, I'd look at the opposing team's lineup, and I was like, that catcher's not going to outplay me today. And so that's one of those things, is you look at how teams match up man-to-man, and it goes way beyond that as far as wins and losses, but as an individual, that was my motivation. And even if it was playing against Yadier Molina, now Yadier Molina was substantially, almost infinitely a more talented player than I was, but there was no way on that day I was going to let Yadier Molina outplay me. And I played against him a lot, and there's plenty of days where I had the better day and the Phillies won, and And I use that as my motivation. And once again, in no way was I better than Yadier Molina. Holy cow, he's a Hall of Famer. But that was my motivation. I try to tell our guys, whether we're playing against St. Paul or Milwaukee or Winnipeg, which we play a lot, look at your, if you're the second baseman, look at their second baseman. I'll play that guy today and we'll be fine.
Grant would like to know, what do you think is the biggest difference between managing professional players versus college players?
There's a lot of different answers, but I will say it like this. In college, we are building relationships over the course of 4 years that last a lifetime. You're going to go to their weddings. You're going to be at their kids' baptisms a lot of times. You're going to, you know, it's one of those things where those relationships never stop. You know, you're getting their Christmas cards every year. You're in contact with their parents. You know, you get to know them on an individual and family level, whereas in pro ball, that's the thing I battle because I want to be like buddies with these guys. I want to get to know them, and it's a tough scenario because all of a sudden you get to know a guy really well. Maybe you meet his parents when they come into town the previous night, and all of a sudden you might have to release that guy or trade him or whatever the situation is. So that dynamic is definitely tougher. Now, having said that, I love college baseball, but the professional, one of the many things I love about professional baseball is it's their job. It's when they wake up, that's what they do, that's who they are, that's what they get it prepared for. They don't have tests, papers to write, things like that. When I'm dealing with the college players, and they are amazing, amazing human beings. This morning I got a text from one of our just recently graduated players' moms. And he's going to graduate school at Duke, and he's going to eventually work for NASA and all these other different things. And it's like, when this kid came to us as a freshman, he was about 125 pounds, now he's about 180 pounds, and he's a man. You know, and he's going to grad school at Duke. And and that's the kind of student athletes I get to deal with at Concordia. You know, so those kind of things, you know, and he, as much as that kid loves baseball, he's got way more important things to do in life than just play baseball. He'd be a big leaguer if he could, but this is a guy who's gonna change the world. And in professional baseball, we're dealing with a lot more guys like me who live, sleep, eat, and breathe baseball, and I love that too, because when I go to the ballpark today, we're gonna have 22, 23 guys in the roster who are just like me, fighting to succeed, fighting to prove people wrong, fighting to help win games, obviously, but also fight to try to get to the big leagues. They have that chip on their shoulder, and I love that as well.
I think you said on a couple occasions, you get the best of both worlds.
Absolutely, and you've heard me say it before, it's each job, and I hate to call either one of them a job because it's more a position, really. It's hard to say job because that entails work, but it's really each of my positions with college and the Red Hawks, they make me better at the other end. Once again, when I first came on board as a coach with the Red Hawks, the next year at Concordia, I was a way better coach. And when the Concordia season ends and I jump back in with the Red Hawks, I'm a way better Red Hawks coach, manager, whatever situation I'm in at that time.
Coach Randy would like to know, what do you do about a player who simply is unwilling to listen to your coaching?
Really haven't dealt with that yet. I think one of the benefits of me being who I am or the path I've taken, that I've played independent ball and just like these guys, they're willing to listen. And I'm not the kind of guy who's going to go change mechanics and demand that they do this. It's one of those things where our players have gotten to know that sometimes they will get unsolicited advice, but it's not going to be demands. It's not going to be, hey, you got to swing like this, or hey, you got to pitch like this. It's suggestions, but more so they know that if they want some help, they would also come to me, and then sometimes I might talk their ear off. But I haven't dealt with that in professional baseball where they're just totally unwilling to listen. I think they're smart enough to realize that even though I don't have all the answers, they know that I don't have all the answers, because I make sure that they realize, like, listen, I made the major leagues. It doesn't mean that I know everything. I have a lot of experience, and I've seen a lot of things, and I do have a lot to offer, but I don't have all the answers. So that's another thing for me to realize, is that for me to mandate that they got to make changes with the way they play or mechanics or things like that, you know, I don't want to mess with their career, because if I tell them, hey, you got to swing this way or swing that way, and all of a sudden they go 0 for 20, you know, I'm going to feel responsible, because ultimately it is their career that they have to succeed and fail with.
Makes good sense. Fred would like to know, what are you guys doing right in the American Association that Major League Baseball is not getting when it comes to COVID-19?
I think when it was announced that we were playing, and there's a lot of confusion as how we're going to make this work, when there's one outbreak, what's going to happen? In all these different scenarios, I think the league did a really good job of being prepared for situations. We've also been fortunate not to have mass amounts of outbreaks. We've been very fortunate that if a guy on a team has been positive, that maybe one of their teammates has also been positive, and we haven't had any crazy spreads. Each team, you know, we had meetings talking about what's at stake, that people are watching. We may not be on ESPN, but believe me, the director of pro scouting for the Milwaukee Brewers, for example, is paying attention. They're watching. Major League Baseball, you know, with their situation, they are also watching. Some of our better players know that by doing things the right way, not going to bars and being in a place where you're elbow to elbow with random strangers, there's a risk and there's a penalty to pay for that, and that's with guys' careers. But the first team meeting I had, and I've said it countless times since, that there absolutely 100% will be players from our league this year who make the major leagues by having this season work. If something goes bad and we got to cancel the season, you're messing with a lot of people's careers. And then you combine with the types and frequency of testing. We weren't getting tested every day. We got tested basically the first day, and you couldn't do anything until all the negatives came back. We were fortunate as a team that we had no positives that first go round. The one positive that we had in season turned out to likely be a false positive, because all of a sudden the next several days, all of a sudden, we just had negatives all over the place. And so I personally have been tested 8 times since June 25th, as has basically the team. And then the other thing is, any time a new player comes in, I'll give you a great example, Forrest Alday. We brought him in about a week ago, and he hasn't been around the team. He had to come into Fargo, then get tested again, and then wait for those results to come back, which takes 3 to 5 days. So his results finally came back as a negative yesterday, so now we can activate him. So we're not just bringing in guys and throwing them in there and then hoping for the best. So some of it is being prepared, doing things the right way, and then some of it, honestly, is luck. We've been pretty lucky as well.
Joe says, thank you for your perspective on the unwritten rules of baseball. I wonder what you feel would be an appropriate time to throw at someone, or at the very least, as a hitter, when you expected to be thrown at.
There's so many different angles. With the Joe Kelly Dodgers / Astros thing that's been going on recently, which I find comical, that Joe Kelly is also all of a sudden the sheriff when he was a big part of that 2018 Red Sox team. Something just doesn't add up. I don't know how he thinks he can just go and police the game when he was a part of a team that maybe not cheated quite as much, but clearly the 2018 Red Sox were doing something. But on the other note, it's like, I'm always hesitant to just start throwing at guys for the same reason that I mentioned last week, and that is pitchers, generally speaking, are not very good at it. Even the guys who have really good control, when you ask them to, you know, throw at a guy's hip, inevitably the ball elevates, it goes at a guy's head, and all of a sudden now you become the bad guy real quick. And that's what I felt about Joe Kelly. If you feel like Alex Bregman needs to get one in the ribs, so be it. But you better actually hit him in the ribs. You can't be throwing 97 right by his head, because not only are you messing with his career, you're messing with his life. Imagine getting hit with 97 to 98 square to the temple, or the jaw, or whatever else. It's like, it's, you know, so that's the question mark thrown at guys. You know, we had some issues with, you know, Sioux City a couple of years ago, and not that they're going to admit that they were thrown at us, but their pitcher threw 2 balls right by De La Cruz's head. And a guy who barely missed the strike zone all night, all of a sudden, because he's trying to hit a guy, it's a tough situation to put a pitcher in, even if he wants to do it, because once again, the vast majority of time they miss, it causes problems. Basically, it would go something like this. Like, it's usually going to come down to if the player had been acting selfish. You know, for example, is he bunting for a hit up by 10 runs just because he wants a hit, for example? Something like that. Is he stealing a base because he wants to steal a base? Or is a player trying to rub it in? And if it gets away from trying to win a game, because there's that gray area late in the game of when you're up by a certain amount of runs, you don't steal anymore, but everybody has a different opinion. So the bottom line should be, is a player trying to help his team win, or is he being selfish? Okay, there's things like that. And there's also moments where if one of your players gets hit by a pitch, even if it's unintentional, there's times where you might feel like you got to protect them by, you know, dunking one of their guys. But I'm going to say it again. It's in my experience, and I have a lot of experience in these situations, pitchers just generally are not very good at doing it. It almost always just causes more problems than it solves.
You know, Chris, let me ask you, because when I watch games and a pitcher will hit somebody and the announcer or whatever will say, he didn't mean to do that or whatever. If you're a batter, do you know when somebody intended to hit you?
Usually, but sometimes it is just blatantly accidental. I mean, even though you're dealing with major league pitchers, the difference between throwing a fastball inside 2 inches and then hitting a guy is only 4 to 5 inches. So, you know, there are certain guys, if you look at the back of their baseball card, look at their baseball reference, they hit more guys on a regular basis. Some of it's because they pitch in. But I'm sure, and sometimes it's a situation where, like, for example, like if you're facing Barry Bonds, for example, you don't want to really throw him strikes. You're trying to throw him inside. And you might even just, like, there's times as a catcher I might tell the pitcher, or the game plan would be, hey, you got to miss inside. If you hit him, it's not a big deal. Not that you're trying to hit a guy, but it's okay if you miss inside and you hit him. It's not the end of the world. It's not personal. It's not trying to, you know, hurt a guy, and it's not even trying to send a message. It's more so you got to pitch him in, and if you're going to miss, you need to miss in and not over the plate. And if you hit him, not a big deal. So there's been times where maybe next week when we have some time, I'll tell you some of those stories, because I got one great one in mind that I told our bench coach Anthony Renz the other day about, where it was pretty obvious. But there's times when you just know it, that's the case, and you're just fortunate that if they hit you in the tail side, or maybe if you have an elbow guard, that's also nice too.
Walt would like to know, he says, that Judge kid in New York is ridiculous. Do you think he is capable of breaking the single-season home run mark?
I think he is. It's just because when you have that kind of strength, now the key is, can he put together in a full season, can he play 160 games? That's going to be one of the big question marks, because when you play half your games in Yankee Stadium and you have that kind of power where you can hit a ball 60% and still put it 10 rows deep, he could potentially do it. Now, it won't be easy, especially with the health issues, but if you go back, because I'm in Minnesota right now, and the Twins love Max Kepler. If you go back and look at the last 162 games between Aaron Judge and Max Kepler, Max Kepler is right there with Aaron Judge now. But once again, Aaron Judge is, you know, when you're dealing with that level of strength and power, it's tough to pitch him. It really is, because once again, you got to throw him inside, and you don't want to hit him, and there's just so many things that can go wrong when you're facing a guy like Aaron Judge. He doesn't need to pitch down the middle. He just needs to make contact, and he can send it 10 rows deep in any ballpark, but especially Yankee Stadium. So there's a possibility, but at the same time, to put together that kind of 162-game stretch, between health issues and just getting hot and cold, it'd be incredibly tough, obviously. But if there's someone that's going to do it, it'll be a guy with that level of power.
Todd asks, while some new stats I get, do managers look at things like WAR or skills, interactive, earned run average, or other similar stats when deciding about players?
At the independent level, all those crazy sabermetric stats, I don't think we have the ability to put those into use a lot, just because you never know we're not dealing with major league players where you have just infinite amounts of information and they're the same guy or just slightly get better. We're dealing with guys who we don't know the level of readiness every single year, which is kind of what we're dealing with. We have guys who are physically ready to go, but they maybe haven't got enough swings because of facilities with COVID or whatever, that it's tough to really use that in our shortened season especially. So we try to keep it simple. You try to keep it to, you know, a guy like Brendan Metzger, you look at his stats way different than you would look at, say, Drew Ward, for example. Drew Ward, you just know when he makes contact, he's going to be just fine. Brendan Metzger is going to see a lot of pitches. Every player is going to be a little bit different. So we don't have access to a lot of crazy stats anyways. And even if we did, we would still want to limit ourselves to, can he run the bases? Can he play defense? Where should he hit in the order? Can he hit a home run? Can he, you know, can he go from first to third on a hit? Can he score from second on a double? I mean, it's a lot of it with us is still the basics of what can this player do right in front of our eyes.
Ethan would like to know, what do you think of those pads that some catchers were wearing behind their thighs and calves when they were catching?
Knee savers. I actually use those myself almost all of my career. And basically what they do is, if you use them the right way, it's when you squat down to give signs, it takes the pressure off your knees about 50%. So once you're done giving signs and you kind of spread out and get into more ready position, you're not really using them or you're not really sitting on them as much. So really for me, they were an incredible help to my career because I wasn't the most flexible guy anyways. I was 6'1", so not real tall, but taller than your average catcher maybe back in those days. So when I would squat down, a lot of pressure would go right into my knees when you're giving signs, because the next time you watch a game, you watch how a catcher gives signs, and knees are pointed forward, a lot of pressure, and almost most of your body weight is focused right on your knees. So the knee savers for me really, really helped. There was one game in the minor leagues where my shin guards got lost for like a day or two. It was a travel situation, so I had to use the other catcher's shin guards, and he didn't have knee savers. And for 2 days of not using knee savers, my knees hurt for about 2 weeks. So for me, those knee savers were great. Not for everybody, though. Definitely not for everybody, but for me, they were great.
Brian returns from last week and says, so I have a Chris Coast baseball card, and I want you to autograph it. Where do I send it?
You can send it right to the Red Hawk Stadium, 1515 15th Avenue North, Fargo, North Dakota, 58102. You see how prepared I was for that? Now that my baseball playing career is over, I don't sign as many autographs, so I love signing autographs and things like that. But yeah, you can send it right to the ballpark, to the Red Hawks, and I'll say it again. It's 1515 15th Avenue North, Fargo, North Dakota, 58102.
With that introduction, you sounded like you're ready to take over for Jack Michaels there.
Nobody can take over for Jack Michaels. Jack Michaels and I have been friends since, 1990. Jack Michaels and I have been friends. So, in fact, when I came on board in 2018 to just coach with the Red Hawks, one of my demands was, if Jack Michaels is not going to be there, I'm not going to be there. So nobody is taking Jack Michaels' spot. He's amazing.
He sure is. Speaking of that, Jack would like to know, what was your favorite ballpark in the majors?
My home ballpark in Philadelphia is the easy answer, just because it was home. It was still fairly new. It's a beautiful ballpark. It's somewhat hitter-friendly. The aura of us being really, really good while we played there really helped a lot, too. But I was fortunate to play in the new Yankee Stadium its first year. That was amazing. It's on a whole different level. Now, once again, I'm in Minnesota, and people love Target Field. Target Field is absolutely amazing. But the new Yankee Stadium is just... it's just incredible with how amazing they made everything. Whether it looks like a replica, but really of the old stadium, but really it's just incredible. But playing in St. Louis was pretty awesome, just the way that things were there. I really enjoyed playing in St. Louis. I also, oddly enough, liked playing in Houston, even though it was, you know, the retractable roof. For me, in the dead of summer, there was a particular season when I was catching quite a bit. I was starting to get worn down. We fly into Houston, and the temperature was like 98 degrees, and I had forgot they had a retractable, and I was like, I don't know how I'm going to make it through this game. I get to the ballpark half asleep. I'm like, holy crap, we got a roof. So I really, really enjoyed playing in Houston as well. And that's the beautiful thing about the major leagues is it's really hard to complain about any ballpark. The first time I went to Wrigley, it was amazing. I was able to go to Fenway for one series early in my career. That was amazing just because if you're a baseball fan and you appreciate the history, you know, Fenway Park, Wrigley Field is just incredible. But the easy answer for me was Philadelphia because I was there during the good times when every game felt like a playoff feel. It was sellout every game. You couldn't replace that type of feeling.
Theo would like to know, what kind of pitcher did you hate to catch?
It was the anonymous right-handed reliever who threw hard, didn't have the greatest control, had a nasty slider. Sometimes the ball might cut, sometimes it might sink. Those guys can be kind of tough because, number one, they're throwing hard. and you don't know which direction it might go. But being a catcher is maybe the only position that when you get to the major leagues, it actually gets easier because the pitchers are so good and they have such strong control. Like the guys, even the guys who throw hard, put it where they want to for the most part. But every now and then you get that nasty right-hander who just lets it fly, and you don't know which direction it's going to start, you know, sinking, cutting, things like that. Those are the tough ones to catch.
We have a couple from Matthew. The first is, what is a television show you're hooked on?
Television show. I am a big TV guy. I really like my wife and I, especially with the downtime and the way the baseball season works. And now with iPads and phones having access to whether it's Hulu, Netflix, Prime Video, all that stuff. My wife and I just got done rewatching The Mentalist. I love shows like that. I personally watch Bones. I'm on season 6, and it's if I have any downtime, Bones. Yeah, so that's basically shows like Bones. You know, like maybe a comedy slash drama type show where every season has like an underlying theme, but each episode is somewhat individual. That's kind of like the shows that I like.
Matthew would also like to know, what types of movies do you like to watch?
I don't watch as many movies as I used to. It's I think with the abundance of really good TV shows that are, you know, 42 minutes or an hour, I don't watch as many movies. But in the past, I did like the superhero movies a lot, whether it was like Justice League type stuff or even, you know, Superman back when I was a kid. In the hotel last night with my wife and daughter, and we were watching, you know, the new Spider-Man movie. So, movies like that. And I'm also a sucker for just a simple, cheap action adventure, whether it's by The Rock or, you know, movies like that. Just something simple that doesn't have to change your life, but for an hour and a half to 2 hours, action-packed. Movies like John Wick, for example, things like that.
Can't believe you're saying that Rock movies didn't change your life, but okay, you know, that's okay, Greg.
Yeah.
Chad would like to know if you have advice for kids whose parents are ruining sports by being completely psycho at games.
Yeah, that's nothing new. You know, when you hear that, it's like people forget 20 years ago it was the same. It's just now you get a lot more attention for it. I, you know, parents get kind of a bad rap in this situation. It's just that now there's a lot more attention to it. Believe me, 20, 30 years ago, it was the same. People just kind of forget that that's the way it was. But it's a tough one because someone, like I have kids who are in sports and stuff like that, and it's amazing the emotion involved as a parent. Like as a coach, manager, and player, your emotions are high anyways. But as a parent involving your kid, it's amazing how different those emotions are. Just, you know, I was the quiet parent on the sidelines watching my daughter play volleyball, but in my head I'm screaming and yelling and jumping and running like crazy, and people thought I just didn't care because I sat there very stoic, but in my head. So I don't know how you get around it other than hopefully, I think the best way is for those types of parents to see themselves on video. And I'm not saying that those videos need to go viral. They don't need their lives ruined. They don't need to lose their jobs and be totally embarrassed publicly. But if they were to see themselves and how they look, I think that would change a lot of people's perspectives. And once again, I'm not saying there should be video, you know, cameras videoing every parent, things like that, because we're humans. We all make mistakes. Nobody's perfect. Even the most amazing people I've ever known are still flawed individuals. So in these situations, like I said, if I was the parent making a joke out of the game or being a jerk and yelling and screaming, if I were to see myself on video being that way, I think I would change real quick.
Clark would like to know, what is a habit you would like to break and one you would like to start?
The habit I would like to break, probably staying up too late, especially in the baseball season, because you know, I was a player for 15 years. I got really used to staying up late, waking up late, because that's the baseball life. It's not like I slept more than the average person. It was go to bed at 2 a.m., wake up at, let's say, 10 a.m. So you get your 8 hours of sleep, maybe, or, you know, in some cases, 9 a.m. So that's probably a habit I would like to break, although I really do enjoy that life. The problem is my now 21-year-old daughter, who grew up in that life, and was up with me at 2 a.m. when she was a kid, us watching TV shows, for example, she still's kind of in that mode where it's hard for her to go to sleep before 2 a.m. because that's the life she grew up with. So that's one I'd like to break, and one I would like to maybe do better at or have I'd like to acquire would be, that's a tough one. I would say the boring answer of just making sure I'm, you know, taking better care of myself in a global pandemic. How about that? So drinking more green tea, boost your immune system, eat more bananas because you've never seen a monkey cramp, you've never seen a weak gorilla, so more bananas, generally eat better, you know, being a manager, even though it shouldn't be that stressful because we're blessed to be able to do what we do, when you're the manager and you have to own the wins and losses, even during a good season when you lose some tough games, you know, you take it kind of, you take it difficult. You sometimes you take it personal. So I think that's why you see like any particular president after 4 years is a different person because of the stress of the job. So even though we're not changing the world like a president would, we should all be finding ways to boost our immune system, which you probably never thought you'd have a manager come on here and talking about boosting immune systems, but we should.
Absolutely. And we end with Andy, who says, I want to agree with Sarah about my appreciation for you guys playing and giving us fans in Fargo Moorhead something to cheer about. Now let's go and win.
Yep, that's the whole idea. We've, you know, I was fortunate to be with the Red Hawks in the very beginning when things were amazing. We've had the last two seasons for us have been amazing. So to get off to a rough start is obviously very disappointed. We all kind of take it personal. My name has maybe now become the most synonymous with Red Hawks, so anything that happens, I now take it personally, because if we have a player get in trouble, I'm going to take it personal because it's also my name at risk. When we win, I'm going to take it personal. When we lose, I'm going to feel it personally. So nobody has more incentive than me to, number one, win, but then also make it an amazing experience, whether it's, you know, the promotions on the field at various points. And as an original Fargoan and an original Red Hawk, I really want to see 4,100 people in those seats next year. So a lot of incentive for me to help this organization out in every regard, wins and losses, promotions, attendance, everything in between.
That's awesome. Chris, thanks for joining us this week.
Yep, thanks, Rob. Good talking to you as always.